I'm Lucy Ferreira, executive producer at biznews.com, and this is the BizNews Bulletin. Coming up in this episode, we have Alec Hogg taking us through the big market movers for the day, after which we'll be hearing from our partners in London, the Financial Times, followed by a teleconference with NASPAS CEO Bob van Dijk, who gives us the backstory on why their share price is up. And lastly, Alec gets an update from one of the ANC's prime critics, Rob Hassov, after the release of the Zondo Commission's report. First off, an overview of the markets.
Thanks, Lucy, and good morning to the BizNews community. I'm Alec Hogg. Well, to bring you up to date on how the markets have performed overnight, nothing to worry about. The S&P 500 index was down 0.33% and the NASDAQ down 0.7%. And this in a very quiet trade, quiet relative to what we've seen recently. And I guess those people who follow the markets every day will be feeling a little bit happier about that. The volatility that we've seen in stocks recently in the US has been absolutely crazy. Among our favorites, there were some big movers, actually. Amazon was down by 3%. 2U, which was in our shift portfolio, was down by 5%. And there was also a 5% decline by one of my favorite stocks, Cloudflare. On the upside, though, those who own NASPAS would have been celebrating, because here at home in South Africa, that share price jumped 23% yesterday. This after the news that NASPAS effectively has been given permission by Tencent to sell as many Tencent shares as it likes. It's got $140 billion worth of the stock. And what it's going to be doing is selling the Tencent shares, using that money to buy back its own shares. That's both NASPAS and Prosus. And it's a very positive reflection. There's a massive discount of 60% between the NASPAS share price and its underlying value. And this way, by selling the Tencent shares, they can reduce that discount. Well, about a third of that discount's already been reduced in NASPAS. In Prosus, the share price was up 19% yesterday. So big moves. And interestingly enough, it started, the increases started around 12%, 12.5% on opening. And it just, as people started to understand exactly what the NASPAS announcement meant, the share price continued to go stronger and stronger. So good news there. On the JSE overall, the index was up by 2.25%, pulled there really by Prosus and NASPAS. Not a heck of a lot happening elsewhere. Banks were a little bit softer. Absa doing worse. That was down 4%. Standard Bank down 1%, and then 2% declines for Nedbank and First Rand. On the other side, the commodity shares did okay. Exxaro, big move there for the coal producer, 5% gain. Goldfields and BHP Billiton are both up about 4%. So a bit of volatility here on the big stocks in Johannesburg. As far as the currencies are concerned, the Rand losing 3 cents against the US dollar, 15.83 at the moment, and 10 cents against the British pound to 19.43. Bitcoin was 2% off last night. That isn't reflected yet in the Geltech basket, which is reflecting the previous day where it was up, and the Geltech basket is 10% higher. Geltech basket, of course, is reflecting its underlying crypto investments, not just Bitcoin. And the gold price, virtually unchanged, $1 lower. Before I go, just to remind you that the big stories on BizNews right now are two interviews that I did, one yesterday and the one the day before. Rob Hersoff has returned to his shattering speech that he gave in September last year. More than 200,000 people have watched the recording of that speech, which was given at the BizNews conference. And there are still tickets available, by the way, for the BizNews conference if you are keen to join us in the Drakensberg at the end of August. There were lots of bookings initially, but a few people have clearly got other commitments. So those have they've had to cancel, and as a result, a few rooms have become available. So move quickly if you want to come to the conference. You'll find the link on the BizNews homepage. But Rob Hersoff says, in the light of what's in the Zondo Commission report, he would not remove a single word from his highly critical speech in September last year. And the other video that is being extremely well watched at the moment, more than 25,000 at last count in a couple of days, is Paul O'Sullivan's take on the Zondo Commission, where he says the commission missed its mark. Moving on to other news that you need to know today, let's pick up with our partners at the Financial Times in London.
Good morning from the Financial Times. Today is Tuesday, June 28th, and this is your FT News Briefing. Moscow dismissed its looming debt default as a farce. Credit Suisse is in trouble again. It was just found guilty in a case involving Bulgarian drug money laundering. And travelers in the UK are bracing for a summer of strikes. I'm Jess Smith, in for Mark Filippino, and here's the news you need to start your day. A Russian missile slammed into a shopping mall in central Ukraine yesterday. Ukrainian authorities last night confirmed 13 dead and more than 40 civilians wounded. President Volodymyr Zelensky posted a video showing the shopping mall on fire after the attack. He pleaded with Western leaders for more missile defense systems. This attack is the latest sign that Moscow is prepared to escalate its war on Ukraine, despite international efforts to isolate the Russian economy. And Moscow looks set to default on its debt for the first time in almost 25 years. Almost $100 million worth of interest payments on Russian government bonds came due this past Sunday with no sign of payment. Here's the FT's Niku Asghari.
Russia has repeatedly called this an absolute farce and unjustified and an artificial default, because unlike in many traditional classic sovereign country defaults, Russia has the money to pay, has more than the money to pay. They have so much cash from oil and gas reserves and oil and gas sales, but they simply can't pay given the sanctions in place. They can't get the money to bondholders. They've offered to pay the interest payments in rubles instead of dollars, but under the terms of the bonds, you simply can't do that. You can't change the currency that the bonds are in. And they see this as a Western problem, that the West is against them, but really it's a Russian problem. This has all arisen because of Russia's war in Ukraine and all the sanctions because of that.
So, Niku, what would a default mean for Russia? I mean, how significant would this be?
Short term, it's not very significant at all, really, for Russia. I mean, the country is flush with cash and the population on the ground really won't feel any effects of this. But in the long term, if and when Russia decides to come back to foreign bond markets and foreign investors choose to buy its bonds, which at the moment is almost impossible given, you know, the war and the fact that it's become an international pariah. If and when that time does come, Russia will face much higher borrowing costs on its debt than it did before the war and before its default.
And coming back to the present, what would a default mean for foreign investors, you know, the ones holding this Russian government debt?
The next step is really to see what bondholders decide to do. They can either demand to get their money back if 25% of them vote to do so, but that will require a lot of litigation, and it's unclear how that will proceed and how that will go ahead. On the other hand, the bondholders might decide to wait and just see how both the war plays out, how sanctions play out, and just see what happens. It's all down to the bondholders, really.
Niku Asghari is the FT's acting capital markets reporter. Credit Suisse has another notch on its belt of scandals. Yesterday, a Swiss court found the lender guilty of failing to stop the laundering of Bulgarian drug money. It's the first time a Swiss court has found a domestic bank guilty of a corporate crime. Here's the FT's Sam Jones with details.
Prosecutors said that there were sufficient red flags that Credit Suisse really should have recognized that this money might be tainted. And two of the most obvious of those were, one, the fact that a large number of deposits were made in cash, bundles and bundles of banknotes brought in suitcases, driven in the trunk of cars overland to Switzerland, which obviously does not hint at a legitimate source of that money. And two, that two of the individuals connected to the clients Credit Suisse was working with were actually assassinated, which again is not the kind of thing that happens in most ordinary lines of business.
So, Sam, as you've reported, the court imposed a fine of 2 million Swiss francs. So clearly it's not going to dent the bank's bottom line. But what impact could this verdict have on Credit Suisse's reputation?
Credit Suisse is already reeling from a number of scandals that have hit it over the last 2 years, that range from the sort of Greenshill fund scandal through to corporate spying. And this is another one. So it's another kind of chink in the armor of Credit Suisse. there's unlikely to be an immediate legal implication in terms of any further cases coming down the line. And of course, Credit Suisse has also said that it rejects the court's ruling and it will appeal this case. So this isn't the final word in this saga. But this is a sort of landmark case in a more important way, which is that this is the first time that a Swiss bank has been found guilty of criminal offences by Swiss courts. So this is a sort of a watershed in that sense.
That's the FT's Austria and Switzerland correspondent, Sam Jones. The UK is facing a summer of union strikes. Last week, the country had its biggest rail strike in a generation, and the rail union is threatening more stoppages unless the government backs its demands for higher pay. Other unions could follow suit. Our economics correspondent, Delphine Strauss, has been following this, and she joins me now. Hi, Delphine.
Hello.
Delphine, before we get into the broader landscape, I want to ask about the rail strike. I mean, what's the frustration behind it, and what's the rail union demanding?
The dispute is about a number of things, but it boils down to a very big reorganisation of the railway, which has been hit really hard by the pandemic and by the post-pandemic shift to remote working, which means that there is quite a big standoff over job security, over all kinds of changes to the way they work, but also, and this is what applies to all kinds of other people across the country, over pay. Inflation's heading into double digits. And what's caught the government by surprise is that a lot of union members who've in the past been seen as quite militant and activist and haven't had necessarily that much public sympathy, this time have a lot of the public on their side.
Do you see this possibly rippling into other industries? I mean, could we see more strikes by unions and not just rail workers?
We've seen more disputes with unions heading towards strike action than we have had for quite some time. Some aviation workers at Heathrow Airport have voted for strike action, and there are similar votes taking place at the moment with postal workers, with communications workers, and a number of other sectors. The big question is what happens in large parts of the public sector, where the government has been trying to hold down pay deals to a much lower level than the ones we've seen across the private sector. We haven't yet heard what the government's offer is going to be for teachers, for nurses, for other public sector workers. And if it does lead to big disputes, they would take several months to get going. But those are the ones that could really lead to large numbers of people striking if things go wrong.
And more broadly, Delphine, has the UK labour movement changed as the economy shifted since the pandemic? And I mean, how does all this labour activity fit in with a new economic landscape?
There has been a pickup in union activity, both in the UK and elsewhere. And we've obviously seen a big rise in support for unions in the US. You know, lots of talk of whether this will be a sort of new era for the unions. At the moment, that's not the case, really, in the UK. It is still an environment in which union membership is much lower than it was in the past. But unions are not the only way in which workers can wield bargaining power. What we're seeing is that in a tight labour market, a lot of people are ready to vote with their feet. They're ready to switch jobs. You know, as we've seen in aviation and hospitality, if you're not offering job security or working conditions that people want, then you will have a problem hiring. And we're seeing pay going up, you know, faster as a result in a lot of areas.
Delphine Strauss is the FT's economics correspondent. Thanks, Delphine.
Thanks very much.
Before we go, new data shows that U.S. companies spent more on private jets for top executives' personal use last year than they have in a decade. That's according to a division of Institutional Shareholder Services. Many companies relaxed restrictions on private jet use out of fear their top bosses would catch COVID on commercial flights. One of the biggest such spenders was Facebook parent Meta. Last year, the company spent $1.6 million on private flights for Mark Zuckerberg. You can read more on all these stories at FT.com. This has been your daily FT News Briefing. Make sure you check back tomorrow for the latest business news.
And now for an excerpt of the interview with South African billionaire Rob Hassov and his scathing take on the ANC.
Have you had a chance to read through much of the final report?
not the report itself, but I read a lot of different views upon it, including BizNews's view, Daily Mavericks, Daily Friend, The Times, Sunday Times. You know, I've read broadly, and all are the same conclusion that, you know, the ANC is a mafia criminal organization.
Helen Ziller, in the conference after yours, called it at the BizNews conference a criminal syndicate. And I guess more and more people are now publicly talking in the way that you spoke. But did you take much of a hit for being first to market, as it were, on
yes,
calling out the
ANC? I did. I had a lot of unpleasant situations. A number of people don't want to talk to me in the business community because I call them cowards or in collusion with the government, which they are. And, you know, I had a few threats. But the interesting thing is, you know, a number of members of the ANC have reached out to me and have, you know, engaged with me to try and find out what my grievances are. And I really believe there are members of the cabinet today who would walk out of the ANC, would leave the ANC. There are not many of them, but the good ones would leave the ANC if there was somewhere they can go and if they could afford to leave. I think it's got that bad at the ANC level. You know, Cyril Circus, you know, if you look around the cabinet, let's try and use the letter C, you know, clowns, communists, cadres. I always thought it was cadre, but cadres, communists, whatever, colluders, criminals, they're all there. And there are one or two decent people, you know, Enoch, the finance minister, I think Melody Pandor was pretty good, maybe Patricia Dillo. They should stand up and walk out. They should say, you know, we were somewhat aware of what Zondo has reported. We're now aware of how bad it is, and we will leave the ANC as a result. You know, walk across the floor, join Action SA or someone else. They should do it. Now's the time. And Cyril is guilty. You know, how can he preside over all of this? How can he pretend he's a reformer? I don't see it.
It's also been interesting to see how ANC veterans are coming out. Omri Mokgale on the SABC recently, really going for the jugular and talking about criminality, talking about the person who wins the Gauteng premiership, and we know who that is now, was simply the one who had more money to buy more votes.
He used the word bribes. He said it's about bribery. The ANC is about bribery and corruption. He is an extraordinary man. I mean, his honesty, his bravery, his wisdom, he's the kind of member of the ANC that ought to stand up and say, you know, I don't think the ANC deserves to win the national election, and I'm going to vote for, you know, Action SA or whomever. I think he's the kind of person that should be doing it. And I really applaud him for his honesty and his courage. What a human being. I hope everybody listens to that interview. Extraordinary man.
Terrific interview. But you wonder why there haven't been more. Now, I know you're well connected, Rob. You engage with a lot of people across all sides of the political spectrum. What's keeping the good people, if you like, within the ANC?
It's a bribery structure. You know, they've all been bribed in some way with jobs that most don't deserve. If you look at the CADA deployment, the DA came out with an incredible video over the last 2 weeks describing how the economy, standards of living, have been destroyed through CADA deployment, which Cyril has been responsible for. You know, good people who got up in the morning to fix things in the municipality or clean things or just get a good job done have been replaced with incompetent people who've done nothing. And our municipalities are falling apart, except in DA and Action SA run areas. You know, it's criminal what has happened. So, you know, you would think at this point, at Patrice Motsepe, despite being related to Cyril, would put his hands in the air and say, enough's enough. I'm not going to vote ANC. I think he should do that, you know, but will he? I wonder. But it's time has come for these people to say, and, you know, take Nalodi Pandor for an example. Okay. I don't know, I haven't met her, but I know her brother, Horsey Matthews. He's a hell of a good guy. And, you know, he's ANC aristocracy and has been all his life. And he and I have banged heads for many, many years, but remained friends and courteous and, you know, accepted we disagree with each other. He was put in place as the head of PRASA to turn PRASA around. And they pushed him out because he uncovered out of control corruption. Now, he has been abused by the ANC, kicked out of PRASA. He even sued them. Courts ruled in his favor, and they still wouldn't let him back into PRASA. And this is a man of integrity, okay, who will not ever again vote for the ANC. But his sister, Nalodi Pandor, they must have conversations at home. And I would think, you know, she must be in two minds over whether she should still be there, because it's getting to very much the last minute on where you want to be, on the right or the wrong side of history. And I think that a number of senior ANC people have a last chance to walk out of the ANC. You know, there's a friend of mine, very senior, and you introduced me to him, Alec. We use his first name, Katlego, a young man who was running to be head of the ANC Youth League. And I've met him a number of times. He's a very dynamic young man. He's impressive. You know, he can't leave. He can't afford to leave, but he would. He's had it with what's going on. He said all it's about is who's in charge and who can steal. And he said he's disgusted by it. So there are a lot of people of integrity who just can't afford to leave financially because of the mafia structure of the ANC.
So it's not a case, as Cyril mentioned in his testimony at Zondo, that he was trying to change things from within. It's more a case, from what you've just said now, of not having the guns to leave.
Cyril is 100% part of the problem. 100%. And everyone knows it. He pretends to be a reformer. He managed to get a whole lot of business people to back him last time round with the threat of the RET group, you know, and they were conned into backing him. They're not going to back, most of them are not going to back him again this time. They don't believe in that anymore. It's time. The ANC has passed its sell-by date and need to disappear. It needs to disappear. And the way for that to happen is for the good people, if some, and some do exist, like Omri and Katlego, Khosi and others, to stand up and say, I'm not part of it anymore. I'm not part of this organization. Its brand is destroyed. The criminals have taken over, and it's past its sell-by date. It doesn't deserve another term in office. And think about the ANC another term in office, 2024 on. We're finished. This country is finished. Over. Game over. Economy will collapse.
Well, the good news is that at least if one goes by the trends of recent years, and in particular the local elections, that a 2024 election will not see the ANC being returned. And there's other good news as well. When we were talking ahead of the local elections, you mentioned almost in passing that the parties you should consider voting for were, and you mentioned a few, and then you said the Patriotic Alliance at the end of it. Now, yes. That's been interesting because many people on the outside would say, hang on, this is a party that it's run by Gayton McKenzie, well known as having gone to jail, being a criminal, but he seems to be doing really, really interesting stuff in taking over as unopposed as the mayor now of the Central Karoo. And certainly the videos I've seen, he seems to be doing things despite what the public opinion might be of them.
The public need to watch the space. Gayton McKenzie is a revelation. You know, I was born wealthy and given every opportunity in the world, and I took as much of that opportunity as possible. You know, went to university, studied business, met extraordinary people, went to Harvard Business School, Goldman Sachs, etc., etc., etc. Gayton came from the most different other planet you could imagine in the universe to me. And he and I have ended up at the same conclusion, that unlocking human ingenuity is the only way forward. You've got to get rid of ridiculous regulation, red tape, corruption, crime, and allow people to pursue their dreams, to take opportunities where they see them, and to unlock human potential. And he is a Judeo-Christian conservative libertarian like me. He doesn't see color, nor do I. He sees character. He sees opportunity. And how he came to the same conclusion as me from a different world is a revelation. He went to his team and he said, you know, what am I lacking to go for higher office? And his team said, you lack political operating experience. You don't have runs on the board as a politician. And he said, find me the worst place in South Africa. And they came back and said, the Central Karoo is basically the N1 and poverty. and the only main town there, Beaufort West, is decrepit. All industry is left. It's falling apart. Okay? And I drove up there and have a look, and it's terrible. It's a shocker. No surprise that people just keep driving. They fill up with gas now and keep driving through. And Gate McKenzie said, in the first 100 days of being mayor there, and he was unopposed, by the way. No one wanted to run for that position. He's the mayor of the whole Central Karoo. He said, in the first 100 days, I will do the following things. And he listed a number of things that no other party had ever been able to do in the Central Karoo, or frankly, the ANC, anywhere else in South Africa. Build 100 toilets in homes that have never had them and have been promised them. He's done it already. He hasn't had his 100 days yet. Repair the municipal swimming pool in Beaufort West so children can swim again. He's doing it. It'll be done shortly. And there's a list of things that he promised to do. And I think his 100 days in mid-July, he's going to have them all done.
And next up, we have snippets of Alex Telecon with Bob van Dyk of NASPERS.
Don't TV like they used to. TV greater than that. Go get your greatness with TCL, the world's number two LCD TV brand, as voted by Omdia 2021. Visit TCL.com for more.
Those who watched the process and NASPERS share prices drop sharply over the past few weeks, but were too cautious to take advantage of the bargain, should be kicking themselves today. Not owning shares in the company has always been a bet against Bob van Dyk's management team. In essence, it was based on a view that management would not be successful in finding a way to cut the massive discount at which the shares trade relative to the group's holding in Chinese internet giant Tencent. Today, van Dyk & Co. came through in a big way for shareholders who've kept the faith. Here's how van Dyk shared the news at today's teleconference.
When I look at the very strong operational performance and I compare that where markets are trading, there is really a very significant disconnect. But at the same time, that is actually a big opportunity to unlock value for shareholders. And to address that disconnect, this morning we have announced the start of an open-ended share repurchase program of Prosus and NASPERS shares.
What this means is Prosus has ended its strictly imposed but voluntary lockup of Tencent shares that are worth $140 billion or 2.2 trillion rand to it at the current share price. Van Dyk and his team will now sell as many Tencent shares as they like and use that cash to buy their own deeply discounted Prosus shares. On Friday, NASPERS shares traded at a 60% discount to its net asset value, Prosus stock at over 50%. That gap has already closed quite a bit after both shares gained more than 15% this morning on the latest news.
So the program is designed to increase net asset value per share. So it takes advantage of both Prosus and NASPERS trading discounts to their underlying net asset value. And this is possible as we'll be selling Tencent shares at market price and repurchasing Prosus and NASPERS shares, which trade at a large discount to the look-through value of Tencent. Just to give an example, right, based on current prices and discount, a $10 billion buyback program would enhance the net asset value per share at Prosus by 9%. If we run this buyback at 20 or 30 billion, this would deliver enhancements of around 20 and 40% respectively.
Which raises some obvious questions that I was able to pose to van Dyk during the telecon. I see the share price is up 12% today, so shareholders obviously love the news. Just two things. Your discussions with Tencent about this, you say that they are supportive of removing the voluntary arrangement that you previously had. Can you just give us some insight into what happened there? And the second point is the obvious one. What level of discount would you be comfortable with, given now that you've given yourself the facility to close this to perhaps even zero?
Yeah, thanks, Alec. To the first question, I think the reality that we are facing is a really extraordinary one, right? Operational performance for the group is exceptionally strong, and we see that we have core businesses that are profitable and increasing profitability. And that's the case in payments, it's the case in food, it's the case in classifieds. And we're also seeing strong growth in adjacencies. And at the same time, we see a really weak stock price performance, right? We can be explicit about that. And that creates, look, it's an issue, but it's also an opportunity. And I think what the program does, and the reason why Tencent is supportive of withdrawing the lockup, is it actually makes use of that inefficiency. And at the same time, our exposure per share, per process and per NAS per share to Tencent actually increases because of this. It is an opportunity created by a market imperfection that we're going to make use of at scale that doesn't reduce our shareholders' exposure to Tencent. So I think that is why I think it's a big bazooka idea to address a market inefficiency, but that also retains our exposure to one of the best companies in the world per share. To the second question, look, the way we set it is we will continue to do this as long as the discount is at levels, and now it's most certainly at very elevated levels.
Does that answer your question, Alec?
Yeah, it does, excepting I'd like a little more detail on what elevated levels means.
I'm sure you do. No, look, we are certainly at the level where we are an exceptionally elevated discount, and we'll make use of that.
Prosus also announced today that it has realized $3.7 billion from the sale of its stake in JD.com. Add to that a near-infinite source of money now available from its Tencent shares, plus share prices of potential takeover targets having dropped sharply, and the group could hardly be better positioned for an acquisition spree. It's a topic that both Duncan MacLeod and I picked up on later in the telecon. Here's Duncan from Tech Central.
I just wanted to find out or get your view whether you're seeing more global tech investment opportunities emerging for Prosus as interest rates rise and as asset values deflate.
Look, I think market pricing is at a level that I think the discrepancy, if I look at our portfolio, between our operational performance and then market appreciation is very large. It's a very unusual time in history. I think what we like is that we have exposure to models that we think are really good. Like we feel good about our food portfolio, we feel great about our classifieds portfolio, about AdTech. We do look at opportunities, but I think the best opportunities are frankly in our own business, right? So we have invested, you've seen that in the results, in accelerating our own businesses. And I think that's been a good investment that will pay off over time. Now with the repurchase program, we're effectively investing in our own stock, which I also think is an excellent investment. When it comes to external investments, look, I think asset prices have come down, but cost of capital has gone up. So I think we want to be very mindful. We set a high bar for anything new that we would get into, given the reality we're facing.
The next question is from Alec Hogg.
Thanks very much. It is actually related to what Duncan said earlier, but more specific. In EdTech, with your continued investment there and in food delivery, I'd like to get a sense of whether you're looking at some obvious acquisition potential to you, for instance. Is it a fraction of the price that it was a little while ago? You've got the cash, especially from the JD sale. And then in food delivery, just a thought on missing out on Just Eat, and if you would now be able to reassess acquisitions in that area, which would be at a fraction of what you would have had to pay for that.
Yeah, there's a few components to that, Alec. I think I like how you say missing out on Just Eat. If I look at the results of Just Eat, I don't think we missed out. I think we managed to stay disciplined and not pay a price that now turned out to be a vast overpayment. So I feel really good about that outcome in particular. Are there opportunities out there in the market? I would say potentially. But obviously we look quite carefully at what is out there. I think the flip side of it is that cost of capital is up. I think we are really confident about our own assets, right? If I look at the performance of iFood in Brazil, it gives me a lot of reasons to smile. If I look at Swiggy, there's a lot of good news. Delivery Hero's core business is also doing exceptionally well. There are other assets that are underpriced for a reason. So we're going to be very disciplined and sensible about it. But if we see the right thing at the right price, we might make a move. But the bar is high.
That's good news all round, as today's share price movement confirms. Process is now in the enviable position of getting permission to access a potential mountain of cash by selling its previously locked up Tencent shares and able to eye takeover opportunities offered at knockdown prices because of the recent stock market meltdown. The excitement, it seems, has only just begun. But for some money managers, could have happened a lot earlier. On the other hand, rather late than never.
Thanks for joining us on the BizNews Bulletin. Please subscribe and follow to listen to BizNews podcasts, where you can also find all of the full interviews in today's episode and so much more.